Greetings and felicitations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for this edition of the Limark Technical Net that was established in back in 1982 and still going strong. As always, I like to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions, any topics, any suggestions, any puzzlers, when we get back to puzzlers, or if you would like me to pass on any messages to Paul and point them at some websites that you'd be interested in him discussing, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to my articles are posted on the webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. The chat room is available for anyone interested. I usually frequent it when I'm not doing anything, but it's a little bit less time for me not to do anything. But it's still there, chat.ac2gs.com. Usually there is an audio stream that I maintain at technet.ac2gs.com. Unfortunately, I enabled it and it doesn't seem to be working. And because all of this stuff is running through a computer and I don't have time to reboot everything, unfortunately, I will have to rely on people to access the audio stream either from the radio or their Echo Link. I'm terribly sorry. Anyway, tonight, let me drop for a sec. Okay, I also want to remind everyone that if you want any audio archives of any of the technical nets, and they go back more than 10 years, and they're very interesting to listen to, long before I ever spoke on them, they are available at Mike's website, which is amateurradio.tv. And take a look at them when you have nothing better to do. The game plan for tonight is I'm going to ask people if they have any technical questions, and then we'll discuss it and exchange ideas about the answers and such. I have one mailbag question from a gentleman. We'll explore that. And when we run out of technical questions, and I run out of my mailbag questions, we will go to the pre-science talk section, where I'll give you a couple of pertinent stories about the virus and the statistics of the virus, and then open the audience for any questions you might have. Now, some people love to talk about it. Some people hate to talk about it. I can't do both simultaneously. So for those people who don't want to hear anything about it, just twirl that VFO. And come back later with Paul's report. That will be about 10:15 p.m. Nevertheless, if you have any questions, I will try and answer them to the best of my ability. We can have conversations on the subject. And if people don't want to ask or talk about it, we can move on to other science news articles. So I will ask if anyone would like to check in tonight, please give me your call sign and your first name, and whether you have a question or a comment for tonight. Gosh, guys, it's going to be one of those things, eh? Let me once again ask if anyone out there has any technical questions or any topics they would like to discuss or any segments that... call sign and your first name. Okay, there's a bit of noise on that signal. If you can repeat a few times. Okay, very good, Joe. Recognized. You have a bad hum. buzz on your audio signal, but you recognize it. If anyone else wants to be put on the list for any questions or comments or topics, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. We will go to you, Joe, AA2IT. What's your question or comment tonight for the technical net?
Yes, I'm calling about 50 miles north of Repeater for Hillendale. And I'm wondering why, when we go in the gas station, with our computer rigs on,
one would hope that they do, but some designs are more amateur radio friendly than others. Major organizations like the ARRL and the Radio Society of Great Britain have endless committees that test RFI emissions from all manner of electronic devices. They found a lot of power warts and fluorescent bulb ballast, and especially solar battery charging inverter units that were notorious for generating a lot of RF. I assume that's a problem with these gas stations, that it doesn't have the proper shielding, and it has a frequency that somehow is easy to get into the front end of a radio receiver. Hey, if anyone else has sort of noticed that, I haven't heard really any talk on repeaters about this phenomenon. Please, give us your experiences on the subject. Oh, gosh, apparently no one else has this problem. So, Joe, does this happen at many gas stations, or is it a particular brand or a particular location that has these side effects?
In most of the gas stations, especially the larger ones, I've used it. I've had three different generations of commercial two-way radios today.
Okay, very good, Joe. Have you considered contacting an organization like the ARRL? They tend to be somewhat proactive with RF generating noise technologies. So have you ever kind of emailed them or had a chat with someone, a member of their RFI committee?
Oh, that's a very good idea. And I was thinking of taking a visit over to their headquarters in Queens once we get rid of the pandemic. Maybe we'll talk to things like that. I might be able to talk to somebody over there during my visit.
Okay, very good. I mean, they're not that far away, and although right now they're batting down their hatches, they're probably the best people to contact and They have some interesting equipment. They can sweep areas and make reports and complain, at least to the right people. Whether the right people listen to them any more than listen to us, I don't know. But there are biggest stick that we can use with these types of situations. So I would avail myself of that if I was you. And please, if you do and you find out any more information, come by and tell us how it worked out.
Yes, that's right. There are lobbying groups, and they can contact them from big manufacturers and embassies and all that sort of thing. And you might even try doing it online, email, put in a question about it. Okay, very much that's all I had for tonight. And you're doing a great job, Roy.
So thank you very much, Joe. I would try an email. I am sure they actually have an in-place RFI committee. I think it's the RSGB uses EMC as the initials for electromagnetic contamination or something, but RFI team. Send them off an email and see what happens. They've been very responsive to me in the past. As long as you sort of know what branch of the ARRL to kind of knock on the door, I've gotten responses pretty much every single time I emailed them. So give that a try. If they don't quite answer during this pandemic, give it a little time for it to cool down and try again.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Roy.
Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for the Weimark Technical Net tonight. And if any of you people have any questions or comments to make on the Technical Net, this is the time. Just push the talk button, give me your first name and your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment for the Technical Net tonight.
Dr. Roy, K2GJE, could you elaborate the problem he's finding at the gas stations? It was very hard to copy him. Over.
Yes, Chester. It was kind of difficult for me as well. The data link between the gas station and the attendant, the wonderful thing that kind of controls how much gas and the money and such, were generating a lot of hash noise on his radio. And he says that he's tried using different commercial radios, but they all seem to produce that. And he said that it's more than one location that seems to be generating this RFI noise.
Well, that's new to me. I didn't know they communicate from the booth where they take money with the pump. Does he find this no matter what the time of day, or is it possibly a lighting giving off interference? Over.
That's a good point, and if there wasn't that much noise in his signal, I probably would ask him, but I probably wouldn't kind of understand the answer that he gave. It's an interesting suggestion that you make, that it might be the light. The fact that it's not inherent to one location would mean that there was something flaky with the light systems of all those places, which might or might not be. So that's a good point, and I'll ask Joe if he's ever considered light. We'll try and interpret this answer. As far as RF transmissions of these things, I mean, I was amazed to find out that these fast food joints that have the little squawk boxes, I naturally assumed that they were wire connections. but I spoke to people who actually bothered to listen to these squawk boxes on their radios, showing that for some odd reason they chose to use RF transmissions instead of just a simple wire connection. But if Joe's out there, Joe, have you investigated at all the possibility that it was something other than the data stream, that it was something, say, related to the light system in these gas stations?
No, it's a day and night situation. Day and night. And,
Okay, very good, Joe. So, Chester, you got your answer. This phenomena occurs during the daytime as well as the night when the lights are out. But it was a good idea on your part.
Comment on this pointed question.
Okay. Once again, if anyone has any questions or topics tonight for the Technical Med and you'd like to be heard, just hit the push-to-talk button and give me your call sign and your first name.
WA2VDH with a comment on this topic.
Rich, Roy, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. What's your call sign? WA2BDH recognized. Who's the other person?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Okay, very good, Rich. Okay, I got you down. I guess you want to make a comment. First, WA2BDH, what was your comment?
Well, I was wondering if that interference that he's hearing there, chances are most of the data communication, like going to the pumps or things like that, would probably be bursty in nature. It'd be like a burst of data. If it's something continuous, I suspect it might be some kind of switching power supply that just makes a lot of noise because of its fast rise time on its edges. A data interference for that kind of thing, I think, would be more bursty in nature, like a data burst and then silence. But.
Okay, I mean, that's possible. I don't know how the line is configured, whether it just keeps on handshaking no matter what, or whether it's more efficient. I wouldn't put it past some designers to just have it keep on shaking hands until hell froze over. Of course, it could be a dirty power supply, but again, it begs the question whether all these gas stations have the same dirty power supply.
Well, they're going to switching supplies on so many things now because they're smaller, more efficient. Make less heat. They make less heat and more efficient, but they generate a lot of RFI. I know I had a problem a couple of years ago with a neighbor's computer, left it plugged in, and it was just charging, and it was wiping out parts of 40 meters for me all across a big part of the HF spectrum.
One of the great debates on the HF band is the switching versus linear power supply. And I know there's a lot of old-timers that were burnt a long time ago with switching power supplies and swore that they would never try them again. Now, I'm operating right now with a switching power supply. I have also an auxiliary backup Linko that has a little feature that you could offset its time constant for the switching signals so that if you get any kind of hash, you can twirl the dial and have it move off, which I never needed to do. I think what ultimately it amounts to is reasonably well-designed switching power supplies do not have these particular problems, although it's easier to make a cheap, lousy switching power supply that produces a lot of hash. So, you know, I have heard people who say that they found these single wartworts that just kind of spewed out noise, and same could go with a PC power supply. So it's more of an indication. I wouldn't downgrade the entire class of power supply. It's just that this is a not completely unusual failure mode with switching power supplies. But, you know, the idea of every gas station that the guy goes by has a failed power supply is a little too much coincidental, I would think. I mean, it could be.
Well, it's not so much that it's failed, it's just that it's not well shielded. Yeah, I agree. Like a little wall wart, because it's mostly plastic in place, it's not going to have much shielding. But like all of the computers, I run a computer right here in the shack, and it's a switching supply, and I don't have any problems with it because it's well shielded. There's a metal case, and there's a lot of metal framing inside it, so it's well shielded and decently designed.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I look on switching power supplies in this present day is that any reasonably well-designed have implemented some form of either shielding or filtration systems that don't produce this action. Theoretically, at the point of CC regulations, that your equipment is supposed to be within specs. Now, you know, some places kind of cut corners and do all kinds of strange things, but again, I have loads of wool warts in my shack, and I test them all, and they all thankfully have passed. So any well-designed, whether it's small or big or in between, switching power supply, if it's well-designed for its purposes, probably should include some mitigation of RF emissions, because the FCC kind of told them so.
Yeah, it boils down to you get what you pay for. So, okay, thanks for the comments.
Okay, thank you. Rich, W2BZ, you wanted to say something?
Actually, Roy, it was, it's in, go ahead.
Unfortunately, you're breaking up again. So you said, unfortunately, Roy, it, and then you blanked. Rich, you having some problems with the radio?
New subject, and if I'm breaking up too much, I'm on Echolink. I'll just wait till next week when I get my new Chinese radio. I'll go ahead.
No, it's okay, Rich. I didn't realize you were on Echolink, so I didn't look at the screen. So I can kind of figure out the timing and such with Echolink. If you want to ask the question tonight, you're free to.
Non-related question.
Hey, I'll put you on the list, Wes.
It's about common mode chokes. However, I was clicking around YouTube the other day, and I saw this ham demo, one common mode choke by his rig, and then he put another one on by his antenna. And both of them individually cut down noise. Together, they cut down a tremendous amount of noise. So my question is, if that's the case, would they cut down a tremendous amount of noise in any situation, you know, with any setup? basically. And if so, why aren't we all using Comet Mode chokes at the antenna and at the rig? In other words, two chokes. Go ahead.
Okay. There's a bunch of things that this involves. Number one, a Comet Mode choke is simply a ferrite that increases the impedance of the conductor that you're using it with. So it's just like any other inductor, the more inductors, the greater the impedance, and the more it blocks a high-frequency current. With coaxial cables, though, it doesn't. There are two types of current going through a given coaxial cable. Differential is the way that we like to supply power to the antenna. That is that two opposing currents in the opposite direction, one on the center line, one on the inner aspect of the outer shielding, and that's called the differential mode. Differential modes in coaxial cables don't really see that ferrite core, so they're not producing an impedance, so they're not blocking any current. What they do is if some of the energy is reflected back on the outer aspect of the outer shield, you have a different thing. You have common mode transmission, transmission of power. Common mode transmission of power will recognize the ferrite core and will respond to the impedance. So you put a bunch of cores and it blocks common mode. Doesn't block differential mode. The same way that if you want to block RF going into odd random wires that are used in your computer, in your radio, or if you want to block RF coming out of odd little connections of your radio, you can either wrap the wire multiple times, which is kind of like the poor man's balance, or use an RF choke, which will add some impedance to those types of conductors. So people generally throw RF chokes all over the damn place. One of the big answers to most questions, the same way that the most frequently answered question about computers is, have you tried turning it off and turning it on? Most hams will inevitably tell you, have you tried putting some chokes on it? Let me drop for a sec. I had another ham on another net that was having problems with RF getting into his microphone's preamp stage, and one of the things we suggested that he do was put a RF choke on the input of the microphone, and that helped. He also put RF chokes around. RF chokes will not cause any problems. They might solve problems. They might not. It depends upon what the problem is, and whether increasing the local impedance to a high-frequency current is effective.
Well, this, he was demonstrating with a SDR waterfall, and the noise floor dropped when he had both chokes in the circuit. The one at the antenna and the one at his rig, the noise floor dropped by 75%. So now he did have his antenna 300 feet from the shack, and it was some kind of vertical antenna. This is, you know, for HF. But he did have it 300 feet from the shack. So maybe, what was it? Maybe the length of that much line going to the antenna was the reason why it dropped so much with these one-to-one balance, or I don't know what else, but it was 5% drop in the noise floor. It was astounding in a way. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, Rich. Well, my guesstimate might be that long length of coaxial cable in an environment where he's in that has probably a significant amount of stray RF is that it acted sort of as a common mode antenna and introduced a lot of common mode noise current down its length. And so when he introduced the one-to-one balun or the RF choke balun or just ferrite spores and such, were not part of his most likely other antennas signal that was being put through the coaxial cable. That would be my best guess on that.
Now, to test it out, what do you do? You just solder in a choke right before the lid, and then, you know, a BL-259, a female, or whatever, going into the rig. Would that be the way to test it out? Go ahead.
Personally, I would be a little less aggressive. I would get some standard ferrite chokes that are clamp-on models. They have these little plastic tabs so that when you squeeze them together and get one that is kind of designed for whatever cable diameter that you're planning to use, although you could, as long as it's bigger, the hole is bigger, obviously, than the outer diameter of the coaxial cable, you'll be reasonably okay, but you want to kind of try and fit it to the coax. And just clamp on a bunch of RF chokes. The beauty of that is if it works, then great. And if you want to save a couple of bucks on RF chokes after, say, putting three or four of them on, and you want to try two of them and then one of them and see if one suffices, you can easily do that without a soldering or a desoldering device.
That he built, he had like 100, 100, or maybe 250 windings. When I say two 100 windings with two sets of toroids. He had two sets of toroids and wound through one set with 50 windings and wound through the other with 50 windings. Then he made another one with only two toroids with, I think he only had maybe 20 windings through the two toroids. But they weren't just toroids, they were also wire windings. Go ahead.
Okay, so in that case, it sounded like it was a legitimate either balun or unun. You know, a transformer rather than simply an RF choking balun. Because, you know, RF choking balun can be anything from a one-to-one toroidal balun to a series of RF chokes put end-to-end to taking a length of something like 20 feet of coaxial cable and looping it together to about 6-7 loops. You know, all those things will suffice as purely an RF choking device. If you have a unbalanced antenna and you want to feed it into a balanced transmission line, that's where you actually need something like a balun to do that transformation. But it sort of, it depends upon what he was really doing. I mean, probably the more expensive approach to use a legitimate one-to-one balun versus a couple of RF chokes. But again, this is a possibility of why the noise level dropped off, because he was feeding it from an unbalanced antenna. I don't recall if he mentioned what kind of antenna he was using.
It was some kind of a shortened vertical that he said they're all popular now, they're all over the internet. He used a name which I forgot. It was a ground plane type of, a small ground plane type of antenna for HF. And as, the way he was talking about it, they're really...
according to him. And basically, that's what he was using. And they weren't expensive to build at all. In fact, the toroids were, he showed in the catalog, $1.36 each. And the wire was, you know, nothing to speak of. And then he put both of them, the two toroid version and the, I think, 10 toroid version, he put them in PVC pipe and put the end caps on. Oh, right, and he put the BNCs on the end. So it would be the coax to BNC and then BNC to the rig. Go ahead.
Okay, so it wasn't purely a RF choking balance. It was a balance, you know, like the old saying goes, balanced unbalanced, or unbalanced to balance in this case. It was going from an unbalanced quarter wave ground plane vertical to a balanced coaxial. That would be unbalanced as well. So I don't quite understand. I guess maybe it was an un. The bottom line is you can do RF choking in a bunch of different ways. If for you the design and the soldering and all that is beneficial, is easier for you to do. To me personally, putting some ferrite clamps on a coaxial cable, especially if it works, is sufficient. I mean, I don't know if you could save some money building your own RF balance. I assume that at the very least you have to buy an enclosure and seal it up nicely, and if it gets wet, it's a lot of trouble, although you mentioned PVC. So, you know, it depends what you're ready to do. I would, generally speaking, get a bunch of ferrite clamps anyway. I think most people have them in one drawer or another on their shack. And it's always good to try it out. I would try that first before playing around with the different onions and such. But, you know, your mileage might vary.
Have you noticed, do you have those clamp-on ferrite cores? Have you noticed a big drop in the noise floor on your radio, Roy?
Thankfully, I don't have much of a high noise floor generally. I've implemented what's called the W2DU balun at the feed point of most of my HF antennas, which basically is six or seven nice, big, beefy ferrite clamps, and then I dropped a heat-shrinking with glue tube over them and heated them up and sealed them for weather. So I have not really had an opportunity to do A and B. I just, out of the gate, decided to put those up. But those are placed up at the antenna feed. I haven't really found the need to put too many balluns nearby. I've used them off and on. Usually that's an indication that there's something wrong someplace else, because for the most part, transmitters shouldn't be that terribly RF leaky. And you shouldn't really get much common mode reflection back down your transmission line. So I've been fortunate in that for the most part, I've been able to get away by just having those ferrites there. I have put ferrites on microphone inputs that were not properly coaxial shielded, but that was just because they weren't really designed for radio use, so they didn't have the proper shielding. And a couple of loops and a ferrite clamp, and solve my problem.
It could very well be, you know, the how long his run was of cable, and in combination with the type of antenna that he was using that got those, you know, that type of dramatic result. That I don't know, but you'd say, well, you have said a few times already. You know, try the clamp-ons first. See how much noise you lose with those, and then take it from there. So that's it. Thanks, Roy. W2BZ.
Okay, Rich, you're welcome. And like I said, most people are inevitably at one point or another going to ask you if you have RF choke because it's like an aspirin. You know, take two aspirins and call me in the morning. So it's always nice to have them, and they're relatively inexpensive. They're basically glorified rust with some plasticizer in it, and make sure that you get a proper mix for the bands that you plan to be using them on.
Well, those bands seem to be getting better and better. I keep hearing a few signals here and there with my little loop antenna, receiving loop antenna, on 17 now, which is very encouraging. So if I wanted to operate 40, 20, and let's say 17, well, would I need the different size chokes for each band?
No, I guess there's a couple. There's specialty mixes that are not sold to amateurs, but sometimes get sold by eBay people. That's why I tend to suggest that people buy through a United States legitimate type of a store rather than some guy on eBay, because he might get a cheap bunch of esoteric ferrite mixes that are more designed for very low frequency or such. But just, you know, if you go to a DX Engineering or Palomar Engineering or such, they'll have the proper mixes for the general HF band.
Yeah, I think those mixes, I think he said he was using 71s or 72s, something along those lines. Yeah, I know whether it's in the 50s, 52, 55, or in the 70s, there are suggested mixes for you know, the HF bands. So, all right, thanks, Roy. W2BZ, back to net.
You're welcome, Rich. Next up is Wesley, N2XJN. What's your topic, comment, or question tonight, Wesley?
I have two of them. One is related, one is not related. Which one you would like you me to start with?
Well, let's try the related one.
Okay. You mentioned two modes in the coax, a common mode and the pre-shell mode, and I thought it would be good if we could touch the subject with more of an explanation from the scientific field, but rather a pointing at practicality of it. Would you like me to continue?
Okay, Wesley.
So, when we're dealing with a shield of the coaxial cable, and we dealing with two currents that are equal but opposite from each other and canceling each other, so we might go to the explanation of skin effect when direct current passes through the conductor, it tends to uniformly use the entire cross-sectional area of the conductor. And here's an interesting point. So let's say we have a wire that is iron inside, but it's copper coated, and then we have a shield, and of course we have a dielectric on it. The 63% of the entire current at 1 megahertz flows through outer 0.67 millimeters, so 67 thousandths of the millimeter of the copper wire. So if that iron wire is coated with copper, then at frequencies 1 megahertz and even lower than that, due to the thickness of the coating, we would never see an increase of any resistance, or actually it's not the resistance, any impact of the iron inside. Okay, let me go forward. So, we may say that there is a certain thickness, X. So if we have a 5X, we have a 5 thicknesses of the skin depth at given frequencies. So 98% of the current is contained in 4 script depth, skin depth at 0.298 of the millimeter from the surface of the wire. The past 5 skin depths, there is, for all practical purposes, no current flowing in the wire. Phenomena is limited. When alternating current flow going through the conductor, this conductor is in close proximity to another conductor carrying another current, then the current in the conductors will tend to be crowded into the smaller regions of the conductor, resulting in increased resistance. So it is An addition to the skin effect. The proximity effect tends to further increase the effective resistance of the conductor beyond that of the skin effect alone. You can easily experiment by yourself. Take two wires carrying alternating current and actually you wouldn't be able to measure the resistance. You would see the impedance of it, and the resistance would be one of the factors of it. Let me know. So now let's go to the coaxial cable. The closer the two wires, the more impact carrying alternating current, the more impact on the crowding of the regions where the current flows. I don't know if I'm using the proper language, makes. So now we connect the shield as if it would be used in the usual condition for amateur guy in his amateur application. We have current flowing on the outside of the shield due to the skin effect that is fully cancelled out due to the opposite induced current from the inner conductor described earlier. This leaves us with only the current on the inside of the other conductor. It should be clear from this description that the result of the current flowing only on the inside of the outer conductor is therefore the result of both the skin effect and proximity effect. I believe that helps into the further discussion if you want to make it about common mode and differential mode, but actually I was pounding on the common mode. And to XGS.
Okay, Wesley, Dick many times discussed, the skin effect is a consequence of eddy currents being produced by the RF current through solid conducting material. That's most effective towards the center portion of the conductor, and less that neutralizes the current, and so interfaces between the dielectric and the current and the conductor, which is the skin of the conductor, is where most of the actual current is allowed to flow, because as you go deeper in, the eddy current would oppose the current flow, and that's sort of what the skin effect is. A proximity effect is kind of designed into the model, as far as I understand, of coaxial cables, because it's a core covered by a circular shield. There's no difference in a well-designed coaxial cable for the inside surface versus the outer surface of the central wire. So it's not so much proximity effect as it is skin effect. But I mean, that's used all the time. There are people who buy stainless steel wire antennas, which are terrible conductors, but they're coated with a thin layer of copper, which is an excellent. It's why a lot of copper, a lot of silver inductors only are silver plated, because you just need it to be on the very, very surface. Why waste all the money on all that solid silver? So that's my sensibility of skin effect and proximity effect when it comes to coaxial cables.
I may try a little bit more, say, about the proximity effect. Okay. If we bring another conductor carrying an alternating current, and that could be, say, antenna element, in close proximity to the coax. So we have that element close to the coax. It will induce a current in the shield. If the shield is several skin depths thick, so that we measure the thickness of how deep is the current in skin thickness, none of this induced current will appear on the inside of the shell conductor or anywhere else inside the coaxial cable, but rather it will flow on the outside of the shell due to skin effect. And this is a kind of unique condition. But we have more than one. We have two unique currents flowing on the shield of the coax. The current flowing on inside of the shield that is generated by transmitter connected to the coax, as well as the current that is flowing on outside of the shield due to magnetic coupling from the antenna. And to a shield.
Okay, Wesley, but what might be the point?
But the point is that since the two currents have no interaction along the length of the coax, it is for all practical purposes, if they are traveling on separate wires, the coaxial common mode current, the exterior of the shield is often thought or described as the third wire of the coaxial cable. And that's what I wanted to point at. Of course, that is simply the observable characteristic. And to achieve
AC2, GS. Well, I agree with you, Wesley. As a matter of fact, when we began all this, I tried to make a point, and perhaps I failed, that the differential current is going on the surface of the central wire and the inner aspect of the outer shield, while the third component, the common mode reflected or just common mode component, is mostly running on the outer aspect of that outer shield. So that's it's pretty much kind of what I said before.
If you said it, I simply didn't catch it. I do apologize for it.
No problem, Wesley. We had an opportunity to repeat it to the people listening, so hopefully they have a better grasp of it.
The non-related subject is Dr. Roy, my friend. How do you manage as a doctor by yourself practically to avoid exposure to the virus? I mean, in your practice, in your field, it is not as easy as for us to simply hide at home and to exhale.
Well, you know, Wesley, I don't want to make any of this about myself. It's not like I'm a hospitalist and I'm in emergency rooms, and it pretty much breaks my heart when I see all the hospitals that I've trained in all over the metropolitan area with refrigeration trucks in the back storing the deceased, and occasionally videotape of emergency rooms that I once worked in long ago. But, you know, that's not where I am, thankfully, and at my age. I'd rather not go into details of how it's impacting me, because I'm just one person. I prefer to look at the big picture.
Yes, I understand that. So knowing that you're just 20, you're in lower risk. And 20.
Thank you very much, Wesley. I wish that was an accurate assessment.
Thank you very much, Roy.
Okay, thank you, Wesley. Let me also mention, a couple of, either months ago, probably about 8-9 months ago, there was some discussion of how do you get a surge protection with using twin lines, and I think I mentioned that Array Solutions had a design for a surge protector for open wire lines. Also, I just recently noticed that DX Engineering has developed a ladder line surge protector of its very own. It says that it apparently works with 450 ohm and 300 ohm ladder line, and also with 600 ohm open wire feeder. It has an internal gas discharge tube and capacitors and resistors, and they say it can withstand multiple minor surges and shunt them to ground, and it bleeds off some static charge collected from wind-driven snow, rain, and sand. So if anyone is still using open line, and it's a wonderful technology, unfortunately, after World War II came, finished, and the Army sold off a lot of cheap coaxial cables, it became sort of a thing of the past. But if you are using open line, ladder line or such, you might want to check out DX Engineering for that new surge protector device that they're selling. Drop for any comments on that?
That tonight at 8 o'clock, this is the W2VL repeater.
Okay, well, it's 9 o'clock, so I guess it's time for the mailbag question, in which apparently now I tell myself what the mailbag question is. Mailbag question is from a gentleman, Chris, a very nice guy who hasn't gotten his license yet, and he's studying for it. Usually he, I think, listens to the audio feed that I transmit, which isn't quite working for some odd reason tonight. Anyway, his note says, I currently have a Marine VHF antenna on my roof connected to a Marine VHF radio. I monitor local marine traffic on, and he says, I live on the water outlooking the east end of the Great South Bay Fire Island Old Inlet Ocean. Then he goes on, I, of course, also have a broadband scanner antenna, a Tram 1411 discone, and lastly, a DirecTV satellite dish, all within a few feet of one another. He says, if when I add a 2-meter broadband ham radio antenna, I'm wondering if I can damage the other receivers when transmitting on the ham radio band since the other antennas are so close. He goes on, I know on my boat, which has a marine VHF radio antenna on it and a direct TV dish 6 feet away from the antenna, it gets blown out and loses satellite signal for 1 minute every time I key up the VHF.